From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Richmond.
I live in Daly City, top of the hill, Daly City.
Noe Valley.
San Francisco, Outer Mission.
I live in San Pablo, California.
Coming up, we'll meet the people trying to find local solutions to gun violence in Richmond.
I mean, our title in itself say it all. We neighborhood change agents, which means we come to your neighborhood and try to invoke change.
Then we'll see how one company is making prosthetic legs fashionable.
I felt like a superhero. It just looked really cool, RoboCop-ish, and I just loved it.
And an Iraq War veteran recalls what it was like to be deployed for the first time.
I'd lived at home my entire life, and now I'm starting, you know, a new career. I had no idea what to expect.
Going into the unknown, today on Cross Currents. When Chief Chris Magnus took over the Richmond Police Department in 2006, one of the main changes he made was turning every officer into a community police officer. Before, there was just a small group dedicated to community policing, maintaining the same beat on a daily basis. But now that's expected of every officer who puts on a Richmond uniform. The city's also trying some more radical ideas, including funding a department that offers stipends to young men to stay out of trouble. With the spate of police shootings of unarmed black men in the last year and a half, there's been intense scrutiny of police conduct around the country. KALW's Todd Whitney wanted to see how Richmond's programs have been faring. He takes us to the city's streets where the police and other organizations are working to cut crime.
I see him, my friend. You know,
where do you live at, sir?
That's Officer Jesse Souza, a B-cop in Richmond Central District.
What brings you to the area hanging out here?
It's late afternoon, and he's responding to a call about a man drinking liquor in a McDonald's parking lot. The drinker is a Spanish speaker, so Souza has to rely on the man's friend to translate.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to know if you guys could do me a favor. The reason why is we get a lot of calls of people loitering and drinking in the parking lot. I'm not saying you guys are doing that, right? But just to prevent calls, if we could just hang out somewhere else
okay.
and wait.
No, it's good. Yeah.
Ask him if he understands that.
Officer Souza's response counters lots of the videos we've recently seen of police. Unlike what we've seen in McKinney, Texas, or others around the country, Souza's demeanor is respectful and personal.
Yeah. I'm not saying you guys are doing that. We're going to get calls because they're going to think that that right there is some alcohol. But you know,
Souza's been on the same beat for all 3 years he's been on the force. That means he's a regular presence in the neighborhood. And the people know his face.
Police officers used to be in the habit, and I hate it when I saw it on the street, of saying, oh, I can't tell you that, or I can't talk to you right now.
That's Captain Bisa French of Richmond's Northern District.
How hard is it to say, I'm sorry, ma'am, but right now we're chasing somebody with a gun, so we have to have you stay over here? It's not that hard to explain.
French has been at the department for close to 20 years. She says that there's been a complete turnaround since Chief Magnus took over in 2006.
So before, we were really responsive. We just kind of responded to calls for services. We were a lot busier, a lot more crime, so it was just going from call to call to call. Now we're looking at it from a broader approach.
That broader approach involves thinking beyond policing and bringing in other considerations like environmental design. It also means working with other city departments like public works and sanitation, like when there are shootings in an area that also has a high concentration of illegal dumping.
Holistically, how can we solve this problem so that we don't have to keep responding?
Richmond's police department started changing its tactics and culture before the latest wave of national police scrutiny. French says part of the reason it's working is that the shift started at a moment when many older officers in Richmond were retiring. In fact, over 80% of the force's 200 sworn officers were hired under Chief Magnus's tenure.
I think we have a culture that's more community-oriented because we have a lot of young officers, and so since they've been coming on, since the chief has been here, that's been the focus, is community relationship and community trust building.
But relationships and trust aren't established overnight.
Some of this old law enforcement culture seems to be still ingrained in a lot of communities. I don't like the fact that this profession still holds mostly white males in it, and that we can't get the people of color that live in the communities to actually come on to the police department.
Right, you got to be transparent to these dudes. You know, you can't try to con them. They didn't heard all the cons before.
That's Kevin Yarbrough. He's a neighborhood change agent at Richmond's Office of Neighborhood Safety, a.k.a. ONS.
I mean, our title in itself say it all. We neighborhood change agents, which means we come to your neighborhood and try to invoke change.
Though the police might have trouble recruiting non-white officers, ONS deliberately employs men of color from the communities it serves.
You know, we let the streets dictate to us, in a way, where we go and who we talk to. You know, if it's a hot spot, you know, where somebody done lost their life or a next shooting or situation where a gun may be involved, then that's where we'll be at. Wherever the drama is, that's where we at. You know, and we try to bring a calmness to the situation, bring our expertise to it.
ONS is a city department, totally separate from the police. But like Officer Souza of the Richmond PD, Yarbrough also rides around on a beat. On a recent drive, during after-school hours in one of Richmond's neediest neighborhoods, he ran into two youths he knew.
What's up?
What's up?
Hey, happy birthday, boy.
Thank you.
You 17?
Yep.
Huh. I got five for you, boy.
Thank you.
Yup. Hey, what you got up, boy? What you finna do? You think you grown now?
I've been knowing them their whole life, so. Yeah, I went to, you know, I grew up with their mama. So, them two right there, super smart.
ONS recruits people like Yarbrough, who know the streets and carry cachet that outsiders like police just don't. Yarbrough grew up in Richmond. He got into some stuff, went to prison, and now that he's back, he wants to kick positivity into the community that raised him.
Yeah, we basically looking for young people, some that we know. For some that we don't know, it's basically a pretty good opportunity to introduce yourself, lay the groundwork for possibly building a relationship with the young person. You know, a lot of people want to change, but they're not ready. You know, so we kind of function around their timetable, right? Whenever they get ready, we here.
I believe that if gun violence was to have a significant reduction here and be sustained, it had to come through them.
That's Devone Bogan, the director of ONS and the brains behind the operation.
I said, we've tried to do this every other way, yet until today have we come to you and asked you if you wouldn't mind helping us do something that we've demonstrated we cannot do without you.
ONS asked the young men to take part in an intensive 18-month mentorship program with daily check-ins from multiple people. They also provide opportunities for travel around the state and even out of the country. And that's a pretty big deal for some of these dudes. Some of them never left their own neighborhoods. Then comes what may be the most controversial aspect of the program, something called a privileged stipend.
After 6 months of one's involvement in our fellowship, they become eligible to earn up to $1,000 a month.
It's not based solely on whether or not they stop shooting. It's based on their participation level in the fellowship. Things like going to classes, getting a job, coming to meetings. Since the program started in 2010, only about 60% of ONS fellows have received a stipend. Still, many people question the method. So you're paying people to stay out of trouble and do the right thing? But Bogan has a response.
We're willing to pay a great deal of public dollars on punitive measures after these young men have done knuckleheaded activity, when we could spend a whole lot less on the front end and I think get, if not as good, better results.
Both ONS and the Richmond Police are getting better results from their innovative approaches. The police department's reputation is making it an example for others around the country. And last fall, the Department of Justice asked Chief Chris Magnus to sit on a panel to examine the training and supervision in St. Louis County in the wake of Ferguson. They're looking to emulate ONS's model. Bogan is quick to say that ONS's tactics are unique to Richmond. But perhaps the universal takeaway is that a city's fate is tied to its most vulnerable citizens. in Richmond. I'm Todd Whitney for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Traditionally, prosthetic limbs have been designed to be mechanical and functional, not fashionable. Now a startup company in San Francisco is trying to change that. KLW's Angela Johnston brings us the story from our archives.
That's the socket. That is the aluminum thing.
When Deborah Bevilacqua lost her leg in a motorcycle accident 10 years ago, she had to get a prosthetic leg.
It's a rubber ball.
It's been functional, she says, but it's not pretty.
It's bulky, and it's a big black bulky thing with a big black bulky other thing attached to it. And then a big gray metal bulbous ball that's for rotation and shock, but looks kind of like Epcot Center. They're awful because these feet, these hideous, ugly feet.
She says it's not easy to wear a prosthetic and be fashionable. So when a San Francisco startup called Bespoke was looking for amputees to test out their 3D printed prosthetic coverings, Bevilacqua was in. She was asked to help design a fashionable, realistic covering that surrounds the metal pole of her prosthetic leg. It's called a fairing. She showed her design ideas to the head of the company. After a long process of coming up with the perfect design, Bevilacqua walked away with a fairing that had her style written all over it.
I just loved it. I just immediately started wearing short skirts and going to the movies and just watching people's reactions to it, which was really fun.
Bevilacqua says that after she started wearing fairings, she noticed some changes about herself as well.
I felt like I got a lot of confidence from wearing the leg. Before that, I would just cover up and pretend I wasn't an amputee and didn't want anyone to know.
This feeling of empowerment is one of the reasons why Bespoke's founder, Scott Summit, started the company back in 2008. Braces and casts rest on top of shelves in the office. And sometimes when you open the dishwasher in their kitchen, you can find a couple of 3D printed arms and legs next to the coffee mugs. Washing them makes the plastic stronger. After an amputee decides they want a Bespoke fairing, they have to get scanned in person with a small scanner the size of a paperback book. Chad Crittenton lost his leg to cancer in 2002. He came into the Bespoke offices a few years after to get fitted for his first fairing.
So what we've done is we've taken a scan, a 3D scan of my sound side leg, of my left leg in this case. The scan creates a computer-assisted design file on the computer like you've seen on TV, that thing that goes around 360 degrees. We do the mirror image or the reverse image of that sound side leg and create a fairing shape of the non-existent lower limb and calf.
Capturing every curve and shape of the leg. Then the 3D scanned image is sent to a computer where designers can add detail with any type of patterns and cutouts. Designs that are influenced by everything from nature and historical fabrics, architecture, or things that are important to the amputee.
I have the one that I'm wearing now, which is kind of a tattoo pattern. I have one of the very first ones. It was just circular shapes. I like the circle motif in art, and then there's my soccer fairing as well.
Crittenton is now the sales manager at Bespoke and 3D Systems. Before we met, he was in Boston scanning the legs of the Boston Marathon bombing victims. According to the founder, Scott Summit, the idea is not to make the fairing look exactly like a human leg.
Because you can't. That's flesh and blood. So we instead try to say that we're making something that's unapologetically man-made. It's beautiful, it looks completely appropriate on the person, but it doesn't try to be that person.
Once the designer and an amputee agree upon the design, the final file is digitally sent to a large room of 3D printers.
This is the lovely, wonderful machine that we print all the fairings on.
The printer is massive. Summit tells me it cost about $800,000. It's about the size of a walk-in closet and has a tiny glass window to watch the transformation happening inside. Lasers move quickly back and forth and build a solid shape out of nylon dust. And from all of this dust, out comes an entire fairing in one piece.
These are strong. They'll survive anything.
But 3D printing isn't cheap, and neither are bespoke fairings. It costs $4,000 for a basic leg, $6,000 for additional leathers or metals or designs. Summit's goal is to streamline and lower the cost of making a fairing so anyone can do it anytime. So someone like Chad Crittenton can use just an iPad to make a new fairing whenever he wants to change up his style. Back in the 3D printing room, Chad Crittenton shows me how easy it is to put his fairing on his prosthetic leg. But it's when Crittenton takes his fairing off that he notices the biggest change.
I realized that it looked cool, but what I didn't realize is that subconsciously or sort of internally, I was seeing this symmetry and the sort of reformation of my non-existent limb. Once we took it off, I realized I wanted to get that back on. I felt this sort of need to get that back there.
It gave him more of himself back, a renewed sense of confidence and self-control.
I'm out there to show this, and I'm not trying to hide anything. So that allows people to come up and ask about it and starts a conversation, and it really begins to bring down those barriers between those with disabilities and the mainstream.
Something that's possible with this unique combination of medicine, technology, and fashion. In San Francisco, for Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
Find more information on Bespoke at our website, klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. Ryan Garrett joined the military right out of high school. His sister Samantha asks him about what it was like leaving home for the first time to serve in Iraq and the difficulties of adjusting after he returned.
You liked me more than anybody else. I remember you followed me around. You wanted to do everything that I did. I remember you came to ROTC camp one year and you wanted to go rappel off the 70-foot tower because we did. If I had jumped off a bridge, you probably would have wanted to also.
Was it hard to say bye to Mom and I?
Yes, because it was something I hadn't done before. I mean, I'm used to leaving now, but, you know, up until that point, I'd lived at home my entire life. You know, I'd just graduated high school, and now I'm starting, you know, a new career. I had no idea what to expect.
Did you ever think of me when you were there?
All the time. I remember you sent us all kinds of food. I used to post all your pictures on the inside of my locker.
I talked about you all the time. When I was in second grade, we had this thing, it was kind of like a show and tell, and everything that I brought in was something that you had sent home. Do memories from the war ever come back to you?
Every day. But I mean, it's difficult going through something like that and then coming back stateside. And I don't think it's just because of combat. I think it's just military lifestyle in general. Like, I notice that people aren't very efficient with going about their daily business here. So yeah, I find myself getting frustrated sometimes at, like, you know, people waiting in line for something like that, and they just all gang up instead of forming a nice, neat line, or, you know, things like that.
What were some of the more difficult things to deal with coming back?
It was difficult adjusting to it, just a different lifestyle. You know, I didn't have to look for bombs on the side of the road anymore. I kept worrying that I'd lost my rifle when I got home just because I didn't have one. But I, you know, if I was watching TV for like an hour, I'd get up and I'd look down and go, oh, where's my rifle? Oh, I don't have it. Okay.
Do you have any regrets?
No. You know, I didn't get to do everything that I wanted to do because of, you know, timeline issues or things like that, or orders to different units. But at the same time, I mean, I would do it again. As for serving in the military in general, I mean, it's a really good way to, you know, to go, I think. I was discouraged from joining when I was in high school, and I was actually only one of two people that joined the military. My high school really liked to play off, you know, if you don't go to college right away, you're not going to be successful. And I came out of it with a very good job. When I was 18 years old, I had, you know, I had my own money. I ended up learning how to fly a helicopter, sort of. There's a lot of things that I got to do that I think a lot of normal people don't get to do. Going to Iraq, you know, at first was a scary thought, not knowing what to expect, but for the most part, I mean, it was a boring experience, but it was also an interesting experience, you know, getting to see how other people live, and you really get an appreciation for what we have back home when you see how the rest of the world can be sometimes.
That story was produced by KLW's Ryan Miller. You can book a StoryCorps interview with your loved one. We'll show you how at klw.org. Or if you have a story you want us to cover, let us know on our tip line. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Jeremy Dalmas, Audrey Dilling, Catherine Girardeau, Berenice Freedom, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Holly J. McDeed, Casey Miner, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. Geographers fight to keep their subject alive in schools.
Geography is really the mother of all social science, and everything can kind of flow from a study of geography.
Rebranding Geography, that's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Oh, darling.
This music is by East Bay band The Tea Sisters. They perform at the 6th annual Backyard Concert taking place Saturday afternoon in Santa Rosa. Find more information at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
For a long time, couldn't live inside these blues. Perk up, darling, darling, ooh. You're gonna make it too.